The topics discussed are for general educational purposes only and should be considered advice. Consult your financial or tax professional prior to making any decisions to ensure your specific situation is addressed. The information in this broadcast is provided for informational purposes only. It is not offered as and does not constitute legal advice. The use of this broadcast or any information provided in it does not create an attorney-client relationship. All anecdotes are for illustrative and educational purposes only. This broadcast may be considered advertising under the California Rules of Professional Conduct. James Bogan does not make any guarantees, warranties, or predictions to the outcome of any potential cases. Consult an attorney familiar with California and federal law before making any decisions.
Welcome, ESPN 1700 AM. It's the Real Estate Radio Hour with your host,
Big Mac, David McKelvin.
And myself, Ryan White. Happy Thursday. We have with us today, James Bogan, attorney at law with Irwin and Associates. He's an estate planning attorney right here in Carmel Valley. And we're going to be talking about estate planning, surprisingly enough. Most specifically, the seven most common mistakes of estate planning. Not necessarily any specific order, and he's got some pretty unique sports analogies for us that I think will be interesting out there. James, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Also with us today, Brent Armstrong, certified financial planner, works with Weatherly Asset Management right here in Del Mar, and strangely enough, going to talk more about planning. In this case, financial planning, and he has nine steps to financial success. I would imagine there probably are a few more, but you boiled it down to basically nine, and you know, we might be able to wrap our head around nine. The 10,000 of them out there, far too big of a list.
We dropped off that 10th one, which is the one that we're going to reveal at the end of the show that will let everybody that listens here into some secrets with Brent Armstrong here, the certified financial planner that is actually killing it right now. We've got some secrets that we're going to reveal to you guys. Ryan, are you ready to go into the show or what?
Yeah, I think that's why we're here. So, James, tell me what an estate plan is.
Well, I guess the biggest two questions I get when clients come to see us are who's in charge of their kids if something were to happen to them, and then who's in charge of the money. But the main objectives for any estate plan is to move assets quickly, quietly, and cheaply, because apparently nobody likes naming the IRS as one of their beneficiaries to their estate plan. So I guess that's how you boil it down to the most common denominator.
An understanding of where your stuff goes when you're not able to direct it yourself.
Absolutely.
And I think one of the things that's valuable to point out here is when many people think of an estate plan, they assume you have to have millions and millions of dollars. I run across that question a lot. That's not necessarily the truth. Everybody needs one, right?
Absolutely. Especially anybody that has any kids or have any real estate in their own name. They absolutely need an estate plan or some sort of planning to prep for any contingencies that happen out there that they don't plan for.
And they always happen. I mean, that's such is life, right?
That's why I'm employed.
That's why you're employed. Okay, so you've got seven most common mistakes of estate planning. So one would could extrapolate from this that there are other mistakes, perhaps less common, but you've boiled it down to a list of seven. And we'll get through as many as we can on the show, but there are also, you can go find James through LinkedIn. Go ahead and join, link up with him, and you can get the list of the seven most common mistakes of estate planning. So you have here number one, passing away without anything in place. What does that mean?
This means that you pass away without a will or a trust or any type of legal infrastructure in place. These are seven most common mistakes, so this is what I see most often when I have clients in my office. The example I was going to use was Steve McNair. You guys know about Air McNair, used to be the Tennessee quarterback for the Tennessee Titans. Three-time Super Bowl quarterback. He passed away in 2009 under tragic circumstances. His team almost won the Super Bowl back in 2000, the one yard away from winning the Super Bowl, but he left behind a mess. He had four kids, two with his wife and two from a prior relationship, and then also a mother who he planned to take care of. He had never penned his own will. By the way, you guys know that everybody passes away with a will, right?
Well, tell us about that. I thought you had to make your own.
No. Luckily, the California legislature has taken time out of their busy work week Monday through Wednesday to pen one for everybody. It's called the California Probate Code. So if you die without penning your own will, they step in and allow the California Probate Code to distribute your assets.
So there's a default. Essentially, that's the default.
Exactly.
And why do I want to bother with writing a will? Why not just let the state handle my affairs? Sounds crazy, but you know, let's pose that hypothetical question.
The biggest reason is cost.
Okay.
Time-consuming, and then everything becomes public record. So in Steve McNair's case, we know all of this because everything went through probate court and became public record. One of the examples was his wife and his mother got into a dispute after he had passed away, and his wife wanted $3,000 a month to live in one of his properties.
His wife wanted $3,000 a month to live in one of his properties?
For rent.
For rent. Got it.
And if he had done any planning prior, I'm sure he would have wanted his mother to be taken care of, as is anybody else that was successful want to take care of their parents.
Yeah, but I would think so.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
$80 million ought to get your mom a couple months worth of free rent.
Yeah. Steve McNair made over $80 million in his NFL career, and that's not including endorsements and other avenues of revenue. But when he passed away, he had over $20 million was his entire estate. So it was a substantial estate.
Yeah, sounds like it.
And moving forward.
So what happened? The problem was that he didn't have a plan in place.
Yeah,
right?
I guess that's my biggest question, you know, is that every now and then I hear of these people with fortunes that somehow get missed. I mean, do they feel like they're just going to be immune to death? I mean, are they superhuman? They die, and they've got this big estate, and nobody sat them down and said, hey, you got to do this? Were they just too proud to do it?
Steve, did he not listen to ESPN? I don't see how he could have missed that.
Right.
I think he just didn't expect anything to happen to him. He passed away when he was 36 years old.
Yeah.
Of course, you're not planning to pass away when
you're
36.
That's pretty
young. You expect
pretty young to
be much older at the time. But he actually had a few of them created. He just never signed any of the wills he had created. So if he had signed one of them, it would have saved a 4-year legal battle in Tennessee courts of what happened to his estate.
Wow. He hadn't signed. He had them created and just didn't sign them.
He had 3 blank wills that none of them were signed.
Unsigned.
Wow, that's the biggest.
So he did see. He did see the value in having one. That's probably the hardest part to swallow. He saw the value in having one. He paid to have one made. He just didn't take the last step. And this is the fallout of not taking that last step, which is essentially like not having one.
Exactly.
Well, that's good advice. If you pay to have a will made, you probably should sign it.
And if he would have signed one of them, we would have known exactly his wishes and his intent, and then we wouldn't have had this 4-year legal battle dealing with distributing this $20 million estate with properties, restaurants, stocks, bonds, everything, the whole gamut.
So his wife and his mom got in kind of an argument about where the money goes and where the money flows and who gets to stay where rent-free, and what Steve's intentions were not made available for the remaining people to identify. I guess that's really the problem, right?
Exactly. And then another issue that arose was he had 2 kids with his wife and 2 kids from a prior marriage. The wife didn't want to include the 2 kids from a prior marriage in the estate plan or in the distribution, so she tried to keep assets from the 2 kids that she wasn't the parent to.
Well, you know, so the family wakes up one day and now he's gone. And they went from pretty much having anything they could possibly imagine at beck and call. Matter of fact, it seems as though everything was at such a beck and call that he was too busy to stop and actually sign his will, right? He was too busy going out, having a good time. Well, you know, they wake up and now, you know, they're living a nightmare. They can't actually access the bank accounts. They can't make the payment on the mortgage. I mean, it sounds to me like they went from just cloud 9 to living a nightmare.
Exactly. Without proper estate planning, his wife could not sign for Steve McNair, just like I couldn't sign for Steve McNair. So all the assets that he had in his name, that was over $20 million, were completely locked up. You have to go to probate court, get a judge to sign off saying that it's okay for you to access these assets and move forward with mortgage payments or all the other things that people deal with on their day-to-day expenses.
Brutal. If you're just tuning in, we're talking with James Bogan, attorney, estate planning attorney with Irwin Associates. Find him on LinkedIn we are going through the 7 most common mistakes of estate planning, and just went through the scenario of passing away without anything in place, in this case a will, and the Steve McNair scenario.
Or Air McNair.
Next you have on the list here, not insulating assets from potential creditors. That sounds like a good idea.
Yes, absolutely. And the most common potential creditor is an ex-spouse. The divorce rate in California and throughout the country is over 50% now, and people don't like to plan for this contingency. I know it's not the most romantic thing when you ask somebody to marry you, and then you also ask them to pen a prenuptial agreement right afterwards. But the most common thing, the most common future creditor is an ex-spouse. So my example was Barry Bonds. Barry Bonds actually changed California law when he, in 1987, went to Montreal while he was playing baseball and met a woman. They decided that they fell in love. 6 months later, they end up in Las Vegas. While they're in Las Vegas, they want to elope. So the day before they elope, Barry Bonds presents her with a prenuptial agreement. So right before this, she either has a choice, either sign the prenuptial agreement or not get married to Barry Bonds. So she ends up signing the agreement, waiving her rights to any of his future earnings or current earnings, which she ends up signing. And then 5 years later or so, she tries to get a divorce in 1994. And the first thing, of course, they do is try to challenge the prenuptial agreement.
Right. Wouldn't they say that she signed it under duress or something like that?
This is why it changed California laws. After this all played out in the court system, it did change California law where you had to have other measurements to prevent this from happening under duress or not having a choice.
Well, what would be some of the examples of not signing it under duress?
Right now, under California law, you had to have 7 days.
Length of time.
From
7 days, like a
length of time.
Yes, exactly. Length of time.
Cool off period, maybe.
And also time to get opposing counsel.
It's like buying a gun and signing a prenup.
Same buying a gun situation. Might be less expensive.
Okay, so ultimately, insulating your assets from potential creditors, another benefit of estate planning. I mean, that seems very logical. I think we would all want as much insulation of our assets from potential creditors as possible, right? And so what you just described there is how Barry Bonds insulated his assets from – well, this, I guess his number one creditor there is ex-wife.
Absolutely. And it did take a 6-year legal battle to handle that estate, but he did insulate his assets. Over that time, he made almost $20 million while he was married that she didn't have any right to. So probably saved him $10 million back in 1994.
Yeah, I would imagine so. We're talking with James Bogan. He is an estate planning attorney. Find him on LinkedIn. One more time, James Bogan with Irwin and Associates right here in Carmel Valley. When we come back, we're talking with Brent Armstrong, certified financial planner with Weatherly Asset Management. We are going to speak to him about 9 simple steps to financial success, starting at number 4. Sorry. Ahead of us when we come back. Welcome back, ESPN 1700 AM, the Real Estate Radio Hour with your host,
Big Mac David McKelvin,
and myself, Ryan White. We've spoken with James Bogan, estate planning attorney with Irwin Associates, discussing the 7 most common mistakes of estate planning, and we're going to get back to that later in the show, but right now, talk to a little bit different type of planning, financial planning, with Brent Armstrong.
You know, it seems to me that you look at these different successful people and you see some of them actually filed bankruptcy, you know, and you got to wonder, is it strategy or is it reality, right?
Sure.
And maybe we don't know the answer to either one of them. I mean, certainly you don't have Donald Trump on your building because you're really in financial trouble. There's plenty of people in that casino right now putting money in there, but there are certain athletes that are actually filing bankruptcy out of reality. So what is it, Brent, that people should consider doing from a financial planning standpoint that keeps them from having to do something like that?
Sure, absolutely. And thank you guys both for having us on the show. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
There are 3 people that can use financial planning. People that are asset accumulation stage. So people in their 20s, 30s, 40s, they're working, they're building assets. Then there's people that are getting close to retirement. They've already built a nest egg. They want to know when they can retire. And then there's people that are actually in retirement. They're not going to go back to work, and they kind of come to you to ask, how much can I spend in order to get into my 90s? Because we're seeing people that live into their 90s every day. We have tons of clients that are either in their 80s and 90s, and we have clients that have lived to 102, 103. So there's a long life expectancy, and financial planning is integral to your financial success.
Yeah, let us not run out of money.
Absolutely.
During this lifetime. I mean, I don't know about you guys, but I can see where there are certain people that are either taking out groceries or they're fighting over things at assisted care communities that they really shouldn't be fighting over because they're not with cash.
Yeah.
You know, let us not get to that level. You know, let us make adjustments now so we can avoid those kind of problems.
Exactly. And kind of piggyback what James was talking about earlier with athletes is Sports Illustrated did a study in 2009 that nearly 78% of NFL players are either bankrupt or in financial distress within 2 years of retiring from the game.
Really?
78%. And then in basketball, 60% of NBA players are bankrupt within 5 years of retiring from the game. So it's an extraordinary figure. And what's really extraordinary about football and basketball players is their length of tenure is so short. The average career in NFL is only 3.5 years. So they have 3.5 years of peak earning years. So they need to be saving that money. Now, this is an extraordinary example. Not everybody's a football player. But for the real world and for the football players, they need financial planning for the same reasons. And that kind of gets us into one of the 9 steps. And skipping to step number 4 is get a handle on your expenses and get a handle on your budget. And I know the B word or budget is kind of scary and nobody wants to hear that. And not everybody really needs to stick to a budget, but having expenses are extremely important. Expenses, you'll never know what your retirement number is or how much money you'll actually need at retirement without getting an idea of what your expenses are going to be in retirement, right? So the easiest way to do that is to take 3 months of expenses, average that out, multiply it by 12, and then add in big ticket items like property tax at the end of the year. And then you can get an idea of what your annual expenses are and what you might need in retirement. Then I can tell somebody in their 20s, in their asset accumulation stage, I can say, well, you want to retire at 60. Well, this is a goal amount of money that you can try to save through maxing out your retirement plans, through investing in real estate, through various avenues in order to reach that goal.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking with Brent Armstrong. He's a certified financial planner with Weatherly Asset Management. You can go to his website, weatherlyassetmgt.com. One more time, weatherlyassetmgt.com. And what I think, what I like about what you just said there is really you're starting your plan with the end in mind, right? And working backwards. We're going to predict you're going to be a certain age, 102, 90, whatever that age happens to be.
Right.
And translating that back into how much money you spend now and how much money you should be putting away to plan to be 90, 95, so you don't outlive your money. And I would imagine for most people, that number they should be putting away now is a scary big number.
It's substantial. And another crazy stat is the average American that's nearing retirement age only has about $10,000 saved in the bank.
How is that? How do they expect to live with that?
Exactly. And there's a misconception that Social Security will just step in and solve all your problems. But Social Security for the average American is just a fraction of what your expenses are going to be in an average year. So it's a great exercise for anybody at any age to kind of get that roadmap to success and roadmap to, I want to retire at 55. I want to retire at 65. I want to retire at 70. What do I have to have saved? How do I get there? And that's what a financial plan can tell you, regardless of what stage of life you're in. And to kind of take a 30,000-foot view of what a financial plan is it's a number of goals, a number of assumptions, and a number of expectations all rolled into a single document that an average person can understand and can appreciate and can use to be successful. The key variables are annual expenses, life expectancy, which we've touched on, inflation, and investment return. Obviously, $10,000 today is not going to be worth $10,000 in 25 years. So we have to take that into account, and you have to invest appropriately to make sure you're not losing money to inflation over the long term.
You know, in this last few years, there's been a lot of changes, right? Real estate values have come up. In fact, some people are saying that we're long into this real estate appreciating market. Interest rates are starting to creep up. I mean, things are constantly changing in the financial world.
Right.
What would you say that somebody that was, say, 20 years old would need to do in order to make adjustments to their situation?
Mm-hmm. For younger people, they have a long, long time horizon for investments. So typically, the best steps they can do is save as much of the money as they can without putting them into a cash crunch or some sort of unpleasant situation financially. Max out what retirement accounts you're able to do, whether it's through work or if you're self-employed. We'll get into some of that later, I think. We'll talk about some of the avenues that you can take as far as funding your retirement accounts. But as far as investments, it really depends on what tax bracket you're in, if it's retirement assets or if it's taxable assets, if you have real estate.
Well, let's talk about number two on your list.
Sure.
Max out your retirement accounts. You touched on that briefly, and mm-hmm. frankly, although not overly exciting to most of the youth of today, certainly seems like a strategy that's in the face of almost everybody, especially if you're a W-2 employee. It's there every month that you can contribute to it, and some people do, some people don't.
Right. Well,
what's your theory on that? And I think you've pretty much said it, but why don't you go through that?
Yeah, contribute as much as you can at the youngest age you can without putting yourself in a crummy situation financially. The power of compounding returns is extraordinary. It can't be stressed enough that putting even a little bit of money, $100, $200, $300 a month into a 401k, that growth over time is exponential and really powerful.
Well, I would also imagine the amount wherein which your employer would match your contribution is something that you want to make sure you're taking full advantage of. So if they're willing to match up to 4%, maybe you're not putting in the full 10% you can contribute, but you should at least get 4 because you're doubling your money.
Exactly. Employer matches are, we call it free money, and that's essentially what it is. And it's free money that grows tax-free. So you're deferring some taxes by making your own contribution. Your employer makes contribution on top of that, and both those contributions will grow until you start pulling the money out at retirement age. So it's a really significant benefit that you should definitely take advantage of.
Yeah, that certainly seems to be very much make sense planning.
Sure.
Right. I mean, it's when I hear you saying that a lot of people are $10,000 in the bank before they retire. You know, it's almost like, you know, they're waiting for something to happen, like win the lottery or something like that, or this isn't going to happen to me. Mm-hmm. When, you know, if you make adjustments along the way, little adjustments, they add up, like you said, exponentially along the way. That way, when you get to a certain level in life, whether it be 50 or 70, when you're looking at your financial plan again, mm-hmm. and you're looking back with pride saying, hey, you know what, I've actually accumulated something here.
Right. Yeah, it's really amazing how just a few simple steps can make a huge difference later on. So it's definitely encouraging for people in their 20s and 30s.
How soon should somebody start getting their beneficiaries in order?
Yeah, beneficiaries, going off what James said, is keeping your estate in order. You should always review your beneficiaries on an annual basis.
Annual basis.
And it's not or any extraordinary event. And it's just a simple exercise. There's not much to reviewing your beneficiaries. You log into your account and you look who the beneficiary is, or any major life event. But simple changes, and I don't know if we have time to go into an example, but an example is 5 years ago, a person divorced from their spouse. They had a terrible blowout. They never want to talk to each other again. The assets were split. There's no alimony. There's no strings attached anymore. They are separate people now. The spouse remarries. One of the spouses remarries with a big 401k, six-figure 401k. He remarries, has a young child, passes away. His new wife or new spouse is trying to get the 401k, but realizes that the beneficiary on that 401k is the ex-spouse. So that ex-spouse is entitled to the money, even though it was definitely not his intention of her getting that money. Now, there's ways to go about getting the money back, but that's a big headache, and then you'd have to involve people like James.
Yeah.
Certainly, it certainly does sound like a big headache.
I actually run into that situation on a regular basis as well, and the thing is about retirement accounts, life insurance, bank accounts, if the beneficiary designation is the ex-spouse, that actually supersedes any trust or will that they might have penned that says something differently.
So they got to get that fixed. Well, hence,
what do you do in
your...
that case? Did she get the money?
You have to go to court and try to win a court proceeding saying that you're entitled to the money.
Which sounds expensive.
It is.
It's expensive, time-consuming, and anybody knows that family squabbling can be quite intense.
And
hence the review your beneficiaries every year.
Absolutely.
We've been speaking with Brent Armstrong, certified financial planner with Weatherly Asset Management here in Del Mar, reviewing his 9 simple steps to financial success. We've touched on the first 3. One more time, the website weatherlyassetmanagement.com. When we come back, we're going to talk more with James Bogan and hit more of his 7 most common mistakes made in estate planning. Ahead of us, when we come back. Welcome back. We've been talking with Brent Armstrong, certified financial planner at Weatherly Asset Management here in Del Mar. His website, weatherlyassetmgt.com. That's the website, weatherlyassetmgt.com. Talking about the 9 simple steps to financial success. We got through 3 of them. Might get through the remaining 6, so that'll be later on in the show. Going to shift over here to James Bogan, estate planning attorney with Irwin Associates here in Carmel Valley. Look him up on LinkedIn. It's James, B-O-G-A-N, 7 most common mistakes of estate planning. And when we left off, we were talking about not insulating assets from potential creditors and kind of talked about the scenario associated with Barry Bonds and, frankly, how he accomplished that, although to perhaps an expensive degree with the 6-year trial that went on. Still, he did accomplish that and actually changed California law based on what he did. But it sounds like he had more to add.
Yeah, absolutely. Barry Bonds was able to save probably over $10 million just by having this prenuptial agreement in place. And it's not just prenuptial agreements, also postnuptial agreements. So if you want to get something in writing after the fact, it just saves a long battle in family court and how messy it can get with a lot of allegations going around. So if you can somehow document that you agree to this before any of this happens, it saves a ton of time. But what most commonly happens in estate planning, what we see, is the divorce of somebody, a parent's child, adult child. So parents have a lot of assets. They have adult children. The children get married, and then the children get divorced after their parents pass away.
Mm.
The problem that happens is the parents' estate goes to the children. They commingle the assets, and 6 months down the line, a year down the line, 5 years down the line, they get divorced. And then now it's up to a court to decide whose assets go to which spouse. And a lot of times the house or whatever asset they really wanted to pass to their kids ends up in the ex-daughter-in-law or ex-son-in-law's portion on the divorce proceeding.
So how does one prevent that?
With proper estate planning. The best way that the strategy that we use most often is that we create a separate property trust for their adult child to accept the inheritance from their parents. So there's no question of whether these assets were commingled with their spouse.
So by keeping them separate, it becomes easy to identify that they were never commingled, which sounds crazy to say. Of course, if you keep them separate, that it's easy to identify they haven't been commingled. But many people don't think that that's necessary. And I think you just highlighted a situation where it becomes very necessary.
Yes. And then you just have to counsel your client to be sure that this stays in separate accounts. You don't commingle it with joint bank accounts with your spouse. And then if anything were to happen in a divorce proceeding, it would be very clear, like, these are the assets that were in the trust that were set up specifically for the parents to pass their inheritance to their kid.
Does make sense. We're talking with James Bogan, estate planning attorney with Irwin Associates. Look him up on LinkedIn, last name B-O-G-A-N. 7 most common mistakes of estate planning. We just talked about not insulating assets from potential creditors. We talked a lot about the ex-spouses being creditors and different ways that you can make sure your estate plan is protected and your estate is protected from the creditor, in this case, an ex-spouse. We're going to skip ahead to number 6 here and talk about titling of assets. You got listed here joint tenancy versus community property. What does that mean?
Joint tenancy is the way you hold real estate. If you hold it in joint tenancy, it's one of the worst ways to hold property, especially from a tax consideration. Take this example. A husband and a wife purchased a property in 1970 at $100,000. 30 years later, husband and wife, husband passes away, and the property is now worth $1 million. So there's a $900,000 gain. Of course, we're in California, so that's pretty common that if you look at the Del Mar, La Jolla area.
Totally. Anywhere, if you bought for $100,000 in 1970, it's worth $1 million right now. San Diego? Sure.
So if that property was in joint tenancy, you had to pay the taxes, if you ever sell the property, on the capital gains from $100,000 to $1 million.
Ouch.
As opposed to community property. If it was titled in community property, you get a step up in cost basis. So wife would now have $1 million valuation on her property versus the $100,000 valuation if she ever were to go sell the house.
So from a tax perspective, if let's go over this one more time because I think it's very important. Bought the home for $100,000 many, many years ago, 1970. One of the owners passed away and the home is sold for $1 million, and $900,000 is essentially the capital gains.
Is on, liability.
On liability. There is going to be, and compare that with if you have it titled as community property, the step up in base occurs when the first party dies.
Yes.
And what does that mean to step up in base?
It's just an accounting term that it's what you paid for the property. So you get a step up from $100,000 to $1 million. So that $900,000 is not taxable.
No longer taxable. And so if the remaining spouse is to live there for, you know, more time, it's going to sell for 1.2 somewhere down the road. Theoretically, her capital gains would be $1 million to $1.2 million or $200,000 if it was in community property.
Exactly. So it saves whatever the gain was by the when the first spouse passed away.
So why would anybody own their property in joint tenancy?
I think it's a lack of education. People just don't know that there's these tax consequences with community property. So if everybody knew the rules of the game, everybody would be doing this. The analogy I use for a lot of clients is, what if you were playing poker against a world-class poker player? There's a possibility you could win. But now imagine if you're playing poker and you don't even know the rules of the game of poker. What your percentages or what your chances of winning in that situation. So I think it's just a lack of education of the difference, the tax consequences between joint tenancy and community property.
Well, there are also, of course, other ways to hold property out there. You know, you've made an analogy of two, and that certainly is a great reason to hold your property as a community property. And what he's talking about is the title, the way title is identified that you hold, that you can change out there. It's not something that once you bought it, it's set in stone. It can be changed over time. We change title on properties commonly. So if you happen to hold your property in joint tenancy, you probably don't even know if you do, you may want to investigate that. Get a hold of James Bogan, attorney at law with Irwin & Associates. Find him on LinkedIn, last name B-O-G-A-N, and have him review your estate plan to make sure you're not making any of these uneducated mistakes. Going to move over to number three, becoming incapacitated without medical directors or power of attorney in place.
Yes. I'm sure you guys have heard of the Terry Schiavo case.
It happened
in Florida. It was really popular. Got a lot of media time.
Yeah, it was a tragic situation.
It was. And the husband, who kind of moved on after a couple of years, she was in a vegetative state, was in an argument with the parents of what happens with and who makes the decision for her. This happens all the time. That was a highly publicized situation, but we had a local guy that we had to deal with. He was a local football coach, wife, three kids. Him and his buddies go nighttime mountain bike riding, and they have the whole bit, the lights, the gear, and everything. He goes over his handlebars. He doesn't sever his spinal cord, but he bruises it. And then he's showing quad-like symptoms as a result of going over his handlebars in this accident. Of course, nobody ever plans anything like this. But his financial situation was, he was real estate rich and cash poor, like many people are in California especially, meaning that he had a lot of equity in his house, but he didn't have a lot of money in his bank account. So the wife had to reorganize her whole situation because husband wasn't bringing in any money anymore. So she needed some cash to figure out what to do with this. She finds a neighbor's friend that's willing to buy her house at 70 cents on the dollar, 3-day escrow, and it will solve all the problems. However, the problem is that she has her property titled in joint tenancy. She can't sign for her husband, just like I couldn't sign for her husband or you couldn't sign for her husband. So this is how she ends up in my office. We have the, I explained that she needs a conservatorship hearing. And she's like, okay, let's go. Like, let's go down probate court, get this hearing, get what we need. Like, that's great. But the next probate hearing is 4 months away. Unfortunately, she was pretty fired up about this whole situation. And it just shows if you had one of these documents in place prior to any of this happening, it would save a long headache. And of course, nobody plans to get into a car accident, which happens every day, or a mountain bike accident, but it happens more often than you think.
Yeah, I would imagine it. Well, it happens when we don't think it's going to happen. That's absolutely the case. Just tuning in, we're talking with James Bogan, 7 most common mistakes of estate planning. Find him on LinkedIn, last name B-O-G-A-N. Just talked about what happens if you become emancipated without medical directives or power of attorney in place. Make sure you have those in place. Reach out to James Bogan, find him on LinkedIn, B-O-G-A-N. When we come back, we're going to talk more with Brent Armstrong with Weatherly Asset Management here in Del Mar. I'll speak to him about the 9 simple steps to financial success. There's 6 left ahead of us when we come back. Welcome back. We've been speaking with James Bogan, estate planning attorney. Find him on LinkedIn. 7 most common mistakes of estate planning. They should all be there. We talked about 5 of them. A couple more there. Go find him there and don't make any estate plans. Estate mistakes. Excuse me. Brent Armstrong, certified financial planner with Weatherly Asset Management here in Del Mar. 9 simple steps to financial success.
You know, Brent, one of the things I would imagine that would set you apart is, you know, the reachability. I mean, right off the bat, I'm thinking, hey, this is nice. You're in Del Mar. Right.
So exactly.
You're local, which is, I think, a benefit to people that are living here in the area. And, you know, before we actually went to break and we talked with James Bogan about financial estate planning and such, we talked a little bit about the SEP IRAs, the 401ks and the self-employed.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And you had touched a little bit on what the people that are self-employed can do in terms of their own contribution and the contribution from the company, which could literally speed up the process of putting money away for retirement.
Exactly. And most of the time, what we hear is the traditional 401k that's an employer-sponsored 401k with a company match or something like that. And you can put away about $17,500 today in salary deferrals into a regular 401k. The self-employed people have a different set of tools that they can use. Historically, the traditional and Roth IRAs are one way you've been able to do it, and you can make a $5,500 or $6,500 contribution depending on how old you are. What happened in 2001 to give these self-employed individuals a little bit more power and a little bit more savings power is something called a self-employed 401k. So they're relatively new, and they haven't really come into vogue in within the last 5 to 10 years. And what they are is it allows you to make the salary deferral, the $17,500 like you normally make in a employer-sponsored 401k. But in addition to that, you get to make the employer contribution on top of that. So for certain individuals, they can actually defer up to $57,000 $500 in 2014, which is an extraordinary amount of money to defer, and is extraordinarily more than the $5,500 to $6,500 you do in a traditional or Roth IRA.
So let me get this straight. So if you're self-employed, you're able to do your own corporation contribution, or maybe not even corporation.
Right. Yeah. You don't even have to be incorporated in order to use a self-employed 401k.
And you're able to contribute $57,500.
If depending on age. So what happens is you're allowed to contribute up to $17,500 in salary deferrals. So you have to be making at least that much. And then you can do up to 25% in addition of your total earnings to up to a maximum of $57,500.
So this works a lot of different ways I can see, because let's just say you're making $120.
Mm-hmm.
You want to keep your taxable income down a certain threshold.
Exactly.
And tuck away as much as you can for the future.
Right.
You're able to ratchet down your actual net income, your taxable income, because you're able to put this $57,500 or however you're moving shells mm-hmm. around, you're able to defer all these taxes.
Exactly. And it makes a huge difference on the tax bill now. And then that's all tax deferred money that continues to grow like we talked about before.
If you're just tuning in, we are talking with Brent Armstrong, certified financial planner here with Weatherly Asset Management, local guy right here in Del Mar. You know, we're talking about some of the maybe not so vogue ways that a self-employed individual can actually get ahead, even if, you know, they're trying to make up for, you know, lost time with their retirement, get it back on schedule. Yeah. And this is a really huge deal.
It is. It really is. And for self-employed people, one of the other options is a SEP IRA, and that's been used for several years. But 9 times out of 10, in my experience, the newer self-employed 401k, you can actually defer a little bit more. So it's definitely something to talk to your advisor about and see if that might make sense for your situation if you're self-employed and like to defer some tax-free money and also save on your current tax bill.
You know, one of your 9 simple steps to financial success is talking about being smart about debt. You know, and this is one of the things that I think about constantly. And, you know, the Robert Kiyosaki plan is to acquire real estate, take on that good debt. Mm-hmm. You know, I was sitting down with a client the other day that we sold a house in a little community. And I got a call from one of the neighbors. The neighbor said, you know, hey, come on out. I'm thinking about selling my place.
Sure.
So I get out there, you know, I sit down with them. And, you know, this guy is probably 28 years old. You know, he's ready to go. And I see it. I mean, I see myself when I sit across from this guy. And it turns out that, you know, his mindset is one I think a lot of people have, and that is acquire real estate. Well, you know, in his profession, he was not necessarily as stable as I would like to have seen, and his wife was very stable, and he wanted to rent his place and buy another one and, you know, essentially acquire that good debt that we had talked about. And, you know, it was interesting to me to look at the situation because they had acquired it in 2004, which was a high end of things. But, you know, things have recovered. Things went down. Things went back up. They were in a position right now where I actually was able to calculate that every single month, the real cost of living in that house was about $400 based on the fact that they had accumulated a lot of growth over that time. Mm-hmm. Not too bad.
No.
Beats the heck out of renting.
Sure.
You know? However, you know, it seemed as though, you know, leaping out and buying another piece of real estate may not have been the right plan for them, but buying something bigger and being able to use it seemed to be the right leverage because of the tax consequences of owning investment property and really sitting back and planning. So it was about acquiring that good kind of debt, which really boiled down to money management.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's several different ways to use mortgages, home equity lines of credit, and sometimes even credit cards to a certain extent as good debt. I'd never tell anybody that a 20% interest rate on a credit card is good debt per se, but to bridge you 3 weeks, 4 weeks, and you pay it off each month, that's a great way to use that leverage. But with interest rates as low as they are, it's a pretty powerful thing to get a 30-year fix locked in at a 4 or 5% interest rate and be able to use that leverage on whether it's an investment property, whether it's a personal residence. You can really get in and keep a monthly payment affordable and use that debt to your advantage. Start paying off an asset early, and eventually you'll be able to tap that equity to either continue buying properties, like you said, to get a bigger home. There's plenty of different things that can be used in that regard. And a home equity line of credit, I'd recommend, you know, any homeowner with equity in their house, at least explore opening one up and see what kind of interest rate you can get. If you ever get into a financial emergency or like to make an improvement on your home, perhaps, the interest rates are a lot lower there than they are, say, with a credit card or putting yourself in some sort of financial straits.
Well, you know, one of the things that I think a lot of financial planners talk about, but it's worth talking about again, is the power of compounding returns.
Sure.
Right? This is not about investing one time and forgetting about it. This is about investing over time. So tell us more about the compounding returns and the power of that.
Yeah. A simple example is a person that starts saving $100 at 20 years old a month versus a person that starts saving $100 per month at 30 years old. Just that extra 10 years, by the time they're retired, they'll have double the amount saved with just slightly more contributions. So to give you an example, you start saving money at 20 years old. At age 65, you might have, depending on investment returns, you might have about $600,000, $700,000. Whereas if you're starting at 30, you'd probably have $400,000, maybe $500,000. So there's that big delta, and it's not that much money per month to save, you know, maybe $100. It's just one less, meal out or something like that. And it's really, really powerful. And makes a huge difference in the long run just to start early.
You know, one of the things I believe that really sets you apart from the masses of financial planners that are out there is the customer service. You know, one of the things we talked about, the fact is, when somebody is actually invested with you, what is the process? Are they able to just reach out and touch base with you, or are they going to be directed to the office?
Absolutely. I am very reachable, and we consider ourselves a very, very high-touch wealth management firm. So if you get on the phone and you try to call me, I'm available whether I'm at the office or not. You'll be forwarded to my cell phone. We like to be used as a resource. We have some clients that call us every day. We have some clients that call us once a week. And we have some clients that call us quarterly, and we love to hear from them.
You know, if you're just tuning in, we are talking with Brent Armstrong, a certified financial planner who works with Weatherly Asset Management right here in Del Mar, local guy. You know, I wanted to thank you for taking the time to come out and share with us some of the financial strategies that you have at your firm. If you'd like to reach out and touch base with Brent Armstrong, go to weatherlyassetmanagement.com. That's weatherlyassetmgt.com.
Also with it today, James Bogan, estate planning attorney with Irwin & Associates right here in Carmel Valley. Last name spelled B-O-G-A-N. Find him on LinkedIn. We went over the 7 most common mistakes of estate planning. Make sure that you don't make them. He is there to help. One more time, James Bogan. Find him on LinkedIn with Irwin & Associates right here in Carmel Valley. Gentlemen, thank you both for joining us. Until next week.
Thank you.
Thank you.